important interviews that I'm gathering. So I want to make sure we get as much of the story as possible. Tape ID. This is, it's the 9th of February, 2023. I'm in Darwin, in Palmerston. And I'm with, this is another in the series of oral histories for the Moorabah Indigenous Oral History Project in collaboration with the Sydney World Pride. My name is Daniel Browning and I'm interviewing Philip Phyllis McGuinness. And which should I be referring to you? Should I say Philip or should I Phyllis?
Well,
Phyllis?
Might as well say Phyllis.
Yeah. Phil, did you go by Phil?
Yeah.
So I'll begin, Phil, by asking you to introduce yourself and say as much as you want about, what you would say to someone if they said, who are you?
My name's Philip McGuinness. My father is a traditional owner for Litchfield Park and Bachelor. I lived in Sydney for about 10 years, back in the 80s, and I ended up as a prostitute and junkie, but I always wanted to be that. I knew what I wanted to be. So my Phyllis life started when I was 18, after I left home. Because my parents were very religious and that, I wasn't allowed to stay home because I wasn't interested. So I moved to my auntie's. As soon as I went there, I chucked on the dress. I ended up working as Phyllis at different places, like cleaning, the prawn factory, Francis Bay Prawn Factory. Worked there for 3 years, 2 years or three. And then I met my friend, Mr. Gary Lee, and we became really close friends, and I ended up moving in with him, and then maybe after a year or so, we all made up our minds we were going to go to Sydney. So there was about 10 of us that went to Sydney, all gay, and
an old mob here from Darwin?
Yeah, all Aboriginal mob from Darwin. And, so we went to Sydney and we ended up living in Chatswood. And I ended up getting a job in Chatswood as Phyllis, as a hearing aid technician. And it was like a 12-month course. And I would have been a qualified hearing aid technician. But in the meantime, at night, I used to run away to the cross to be a prostitute. And I went back to work there one day and I opened up the Sydney Morning Herald and I looked, is it Philip or Phyllis? And a whole page of story about me. How that happened was me and my friend Vicky, we were both working in Sydney at the time, and detectives come. And we knew they were
detectives. Undercover detectives.
Yes. And we knew they were detectives. And we just jumped in the car. And they were, when we went to the police station, they were saying that we told them the prices for sex and all that, which we didn't. So that's how come that court case began. Me and Vicky. And
it was a historic court case.
Yeah. And
you were accused of soliciting prostitution.
And we never even approached them. They approached us. So we fought and we end up winning. And then we fought for Vicky because they were sending her in men prison while she was a sex change.
So she was undergoing transitional.
She already had a sex change. Yeah.
And so then what, when they had to hold, when she was held in jail, she was held in the men's jail.
Yes, and that's early 70, late 70s and all that. So we ended up, the court case ended up for about 5 years and went to Supreme Court and then we ended up winning it.
And did it change the law around register, how you could be registered, like how the law saw people who were had transitioned or were transgender. It changed the rules in a way.
Yeah.
It was a test case.
Mm. Yeah, so we won it and I was going to show you photos. You might have seen them.
Nick sent me some photos. It's amazing from the newspaper. It's a younger you.
The lawyer and Vicky, now they've passed away and I'm the only one left.
So what initially it began, so we're talking like, was it in the 80s?
Yes.
So there's that first court case in which you become kind of, I guess, known in the newspapers.
Yeah.
And that was the police charges of solicitation?
Yeah, that's when I seen that, when I ended up getting charged and everybody heard about it, that's when...
Sydney Morning Herald.
Yeah, and they just did a whole page on me.
And did you have any idea that that story was being published?
No, that's why I was at work at the hearing aid place and I opened the Morning Herald and it had the big writing, Phyllis or Philip.
And photographs of you?
No.
Just a headline?
It's a headline. So I just closed the paper and went home and never went back.
Could you imagine those old dears getting their hearing aids fit? Oh, it's Philip or Phyllis. Because you were at that time working as Phyllis.
Yeah.
So can you tell me, I'm just meeting you for the first time, how is Philip different from Phyllis? Like Phyllis, what does Phyllis do? Did you wear a wig or did you have your natural hair?
Natural hair, yeah.
The hair was kept long?
More natural than a normal transsexual, so that's why I got away with it.
And so can I just ask, I mean, in terms of your mobs, you're like from here, just down south, Litchfield National Park, that's your country. So maybe just tell me a little bit about your mum and dad and your immediate family, like where was it, big mob? You don't have to go into too much detail, but yeah, where did you grow up here in Darwin in the suburbs?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Rubber Creek. That's what, in
Rubber Creek.
Yeah. But before that, I grew up in Litchfield Park.
In the actual country?
Yeah, on country. And then the government, because I was of age for school, the government said that I have to come to town to go to school. So we had to move into town to housing. But before that, my father worked for the railways. And we used to live at that railway museum just before Humpty Doo turn off. We used to live there. And then we moved to Daly Street Bridge. And then from Daly Street Bridge to Rubber Creek.
And then you went to school. Some people say around 7 or 8, they realise they're different.
Yeah. But I always knew. I always knew what I wanted. And because of my family being religious, Jehovah Witness, it wasn't allowed. So that's why at 16, 17, I left home. I didn't want to be part of that scene. And that's when I started, Phyllis came out. But I knew what I wanted. I always wanted to be Phyllis. And that's why I'm going back as Phyllis. But as Philip, I didn't want to go to uni in drag or half semi-drag, whatever. So I just went back as Philip. And I end up getting a community in science, community in health degree. And I became a health worker, and that was about end of the 80s. Then I...
This is after Sydney, when you came back to Darwin?
No, this is before I went. Oh, no. Oh, yeah, after, sorry.
It's a long life.
Got to remember. That's why I don't remember much of the Sydney life, because I was on heroin at the time. So, and... Yeah, so I ended up No, after, yeah, that all happened after I went back to Phillip, because I went to Sydney, stayed there for 10 years, and then Gary said, well, why don't you go and do some training or something for what in your life? So I said, I'll do health worker. So I became a health worker, went to Bachelor College for about 4 or 5 years. Then I ended up getting a job at Baggot Community Health Centre. I worked there for 2 years. And then I ended up getting a job with Danella Dilba and ended up there for 15 years.
And now we're meeting at Big W. You work here, as you'll hear the announcements occasionally.
Yeah, yeah. So, after Danella Dilba, I ended up working at RDH, the Royal Darwin Hospital. I worked there for 2 years, and then now I'm here in Big W at Palmerston.
And not far off retiring.
Yeah, yes, only got 3 or 4 years to go, and because I want to get 10 years out of Big W, so 4 years.
Yeah. Now, Kungarakan is your mob.
Yeah.
And can I ask if they're just, you just have to say if it was big or small family, was there just in terms of brothers and sisters? I know we all got big mobs, but...
Our family was pretty small. There was only me and my brother, Johnny McInnes, and me. But we had the best life growing up. My father was a stolen generation, so when he was a kid, he was taken from country too and put into Carlin Compound. And Carlin Compound is on the end of Mitchell Street. That's where the old hospital used to be. And my father grew up there. My nana lived in the bush next door. And, but one thing, by my father being taken away, he was very well educated and could do anything he wanted. And like, I had the best life growing up, even though he didn't like me being gay, but I knew that, but he still loved me as the son, so. But he'd never ever accepted it, only my mother. And now they're both gone now, so I don't really worry anymore, for my brother's gone, so I'm the only one left in the family. And I'm waiting for money from the government from Stolen Generation.
Is that coming through?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The government has given the Stolen Generation $55 million to pay all of...
It's not very much money for what...
Yeah, not much.
Will that be for your father? For you?
For me, yeah, because the government took him away from his land and he wasn't allowed to talk culture or anything. So that's why I don't know culture that much, but I know enough from other people working in health, so, yeah.
Now, after school here in Darwin,
yeah.
And maybe what happened, like Gary Lee was saying that there was a beat near Vestey's Beach, I think,
yeah.
And that he's kind of, I guess the dawning of his sexuality was there, and what he remembers there of he met some beautiful Greek fella and fell in love with him, but then that fella got married.
Mm.
Was there someone that kind of encouraged you to not to be who you are, but was there a relationship or some kind of sense of being loved? A love story?
No, not really. The only love was between me and Gary, because Gary supported me in everything I did and helped me get educated and everything. So it's just mainly Gary.
It's a love story too.
But when we first met, he thought I was a girl. And I said, no, 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 no. And then we just became very close friends. Never ever had sex, but been together most of my life. Mm. So that's the love.
Now let's go back to that journey from Darwin to Sydney. How did you just get there? And you said there was 10 of you, all mob, deciding to, you know, make the transition to living in Sydney?
Yeah, well, some of us went by plane, some others come by car. And once we got there, everybody just dispersed. And William became a Qantas, Lyle became a Centrelink Queen, Gary became an artist, Larrakia artist. You might know Eric Renshaw. She was pretty far out. She was into meditation and all that. So, but yeah, there was, and out of all of that, I think there's only three or four of us left out of that 10. So it was a very interesting life we've had.
Do you remember that first night? What was Sydney like? You know, I mean, it's hard to imagine for me. I only first saw Sydney when I was in maybe the late 80s, but as a very young person. I mean, what was Sydney like?
Sydney was much better then as it is today. Sydney is not the same. Like, that's why I was glad I went there when we went there, because we were looked after in La Crosse. Anywhere in Sydney, we were looked after, you know, by Indigenous people or gay people. And we just blended in.
Hard to think, you know, Darwin mob just blending in. But you did.
Yeah.
Because you were support. There was a support network.
Yep. And then I joined. I know that was after when I came back to Darwin. I ended up joining some committees, Indigenous Gay Committee, and stayed on there for about maybe 6 years, 6 or 8 years.
Who was the, in terms of Sydney, when you got there, Gary talked about how when he was 16 he met some prostitutes in La Crosse and they took him in, she gave him $10 to get the next meal and told him to go to Wesley Mission and you got $20. You know, I know there was 10 of you together, and you probably maybe had a few dollars amongst you. But yeah, what did, you know, was there someone who kind of gave you the kind of help that you needed to become part of a community?
Well, I was all right because I had Gary there, and Gary went there before I did. He went there.
He knew where to go. He knew what to do.
10 of us went. Yeah, so Gary knew what Sydney was like. And so Gary was my support there.
And so you working in Chatswood, fitting hearing aids for old dears, yeah. Oh bless. And they had no idea that, you know,
that I was a man. Until I opened up paper and seen that and I said, oh no, close it up and went home.
Now I just want to go back to that court case, because it was It changed history in terms of, you know, transgender rights. Mm. So when that first case happened and the police accused you of soliciting for prostitution, I mean, what was your first thought? Were you terrified? I mean, what did you...
Well,
did you?
We said no. We fought them, yeah. Because they never come up and ask us the prices. They just pulled up and we knew straight away who they were. So we just jumped in the car. But they're saying that we offered them sex and everything like that.
And, I mean, you were working as a prostitute.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're fitting hearing aids during the day and then nighttime. I guess nighttime was... but it sounds like, you know, the prostitution was almost like a... Did you do it because you had to or because you wanted to?
No, I always wanted to be a junkie. I always wanted to be a prostitute, and I was.
Not many people would admit that to being their ambitions, but your career ambitions were to be a prostitute and a junkie.
Yeah, and I did it. 10 years that I stayed in it. And I have the experience now, and I tell people, do whatever you think you want to do, you know? Because with Aboriginal people, usually they fall back and father and mother, oh, don't you go that way, or, you know. So, yeah.
Here, I'm looking at some of the photos of you from, I think, various newspapers. You're absolutely gorgeous. And, but still like, you know, petite, like small stature. And I'm just thinking, you know, we're fine bones, some of us blackfellas. Did you have any trouble, like, because you were so petite?
Not really. I used to fight with all them prostitutes. Because the first time I went to the cross, I just chucked myself on the main street, right outside of McDonald's.
No shame.
Local girls used to come there. Who are you? I said, oh, I'm Phyllis. Who are you? I said, I can work anywhere I want. This is my country. So they really, they never ever hassled me after I told them who I was and I'm working here. That's it. So.
I'm mob. You don't, yeah, I own this country.
Eh?
I'm mob. I own this country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I end up having a good life with all those girls. We did really, because a lot of the girls were single and had children and they worked to educate the child, hence send them to private school and all that.
Wow. So when you say the girls, you know, the other prostitutes, were most of them weren't transgender, most of them were cisgender.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that's when the police sort of come round heavy and pushed all the transsexuals on the back streets of Sydney, off Bourke Street. That's where that lane, you know.
Where you would probably be much more unsafe.
Yeah. So we all had to go work there.
So what would have happened if you had continued to be, you know, on the main street?
Probably get hassled by the cops because they all knew we were transsexual. And we weren't allowed to work in the cross, only the girls.
That was a kind of unwritten law, a code that the police enforced.
Yeah.
What's your greatest memory of that time? You know, is there something that really sticks out that, like, oh, God, that was the best night? Or was it just the whole actually fulfilling your ambitions to be a junkie and a prostitute?
The best night. I enjoyed everything I did there.
So you look back on that entire period quite fondly.
Yeah, I'm glad I did it. Because you end up with what's the word?
Regrets.
No, you become streetwise and you know, you could just tell if anything's going to happen, and you just leave the place before it happens, that kind, you know?
An acute sensitivity to what might happen, to threat and danger.
Yeah, yeah. And the only danger I had was when I got raped by one of the customers and gun held at my head. So I just let him do whatever he wanted. But we went right at the back near industrial area. He took me out there because we had the sex in the car. And where he took me was really dark. And then I felt that gun on my face. Then he had sex with me and then kicked me out of the car naked. And I'm thinking, oh, I've got to fucking walk around, but go back into town naked. But as he left, he was chucking my things out of the car. So I was happy. Went straight back on the street and worked. That was the only scary part I had there. What's that?
And there's no, you don't experience any trauma from that episode. You just kind of accepted it was part of your, part of the work.
Yeah, part of my work and can't do nothing else about it, you know. But he never ever came back. That's one thing. I was thinking he might come back, but no. Never.
He didn't really need to do that. He could have just not paid you. I mean, was that the point? He didn't want to pay for the sex?
Yeah, yeah. And he ended up taking the money what I had from other jobs.
So he robbed you.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So had a gun and then he took all your money. How much did he take?
Maybe about 200.
That would have been a lot of money back then.
Yeah, yeah.
So from, do you remember what year you landed there in Sydney and what year you left?
Would have been probably 85, 86. Stayed there till about, the end of, maybe the end of the 90s. I don't really remember much dates and times.
No one's very good with dates and, you know, it's not really, it just kind of helps me to kind of think, what was happening in Sydney at the time? Yeah. But when that court case happened, the first one, do you remember what was the outcome? Did you won? What did the judge say? Anything that you remember specifically about that?
No.
Because you became quite well known for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the lawyers kind of representing you obviously fought very hard to get you acquitted of these charges of prostitution.
Yeah.
And there are obviously photos in the newspaper.
Well, the lawyer was a sex change too.
So the lawyer defending you was also transgender.
Yeah. That's Roberta, that. Where is she? Yeah, that's Roberta.
She's in New Zealand.
From New Zealand, I see. She's Pakeha, and there's a photo of you coming out of the court. You've got a smile on, you're wearing sunglasses, you've got your handbag, and you were defended by someone who was transgender. Mm. So you reckon that helped the case?
Yes, I reckon, because she really fought for it. I think the police knew she was a transgender too, but she knew what she was doing, you know, she fought very hard.
Did you ever, you didn't expect to become an activist of any kind?
No.
It wasn't really your thing, you weren't, no. Although you come from a very highly politically active family.
Yeah, my father was, he was pretty active.
My McGuinness is trade, very much affiliated with the trade union movement.
Yeah, my uncle Joe McGuinness, he fought for the workers' union.
But it was never something that you kind of aspired to do. You just kind of, that's how it ended.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I just did what I wanted to do.
And so that second case where you're trying to prove, just secure some rights around your transgender identity. And the other person in the case is trying to, being held in a men's prison.
Mm.
So were you ever held in a men's prison or arrested and ever in a situation where you were clearly endangered?
Not really, because every time I did go to prison, they put us in a selected area where gay people and transgender and child molesters and all that together in one area. So there wasn't really. The first time I went into prison, I cried because I had to leave.
You had to leave?
You know, it was the end of my time. Because when I went in there, everybody just come. So I was right, I had everything. They looked after me.
In prison?
Mm.
Are the inmates?
Yeah.
Are the blackfellas?
Mm. And one part there, I went in and one Aboriginal fella, he sort of was boyfriend. And he was doing life or something for murder. And he looked after me. And then maybe after about 6 months later, he ended up killing himself, poor thing. In prison. And that sort of, because we became really close. Yes. And a lot of the trannies used to go back into prison to get their drugs.
Because back in the day they were supplied with what?
Yeah.
With methadone.
You want.
Oh, really?
In prison.
What kind of drugs?
Heroin, marijuana, speed.
Illegally or legally? You weren't being handed the drugs out by the prison guards. There was just a lot of drugs in jail.
But I think it was the prison guards that were supplying it.
Unofficially. Mm. So how many times did you go to jail?
Probably about 6 times, and the longest would have been about 3 weeks.
Mm. And that fellow that who took you for his partner, his boyfriend, girlfriend rather. Do you remember, have fond memories of him or? You kind of had to. He protected you from
Because when they know you're a tranny going into jail,
what happens?
They usually write a little note if they want to go with you, and they give you that note to tell you, would you be my partner and that kind. And he did that to me.
You got a love note?
Yeah. And we all get them. All the trannies get them if somebody wants to be your partner.
And do you look on that relationship as kind of one of the loves of your life or not really?
Well, that's the first time I've been with a black man. And I think that I thought that would never happen, you know, but it did, and it was good while it lasted. But what made me really upset was after when I found out after 6 months, you know. Yeah.
So the longest time you would have spent with him would have been 3 weeks, because the longest spell you ever had in jail.
Yeah. Yes. So I was really happy when I end up getting him.
Can I ask, the time that you went, when you first moved to Sydney, is when we're haunted by the spectre of HIV and AIDS. And back in that time, you know, positive diagnosis generally was, I hate to say it, but a death sentence. Mm. And people were dying left, right and centre. And the party kind of was a little bit over.
Yeah.
What was it like in that atmosphere?
Coming back to Darwin after that 10 years and I end up getting tested and I was positive. And now it's 20-something years I've been positive.
when you got that diagnosis, because you would have, like me, been around when, you know, there was a lot of fear around HIV and it could only end one way. That's what we were always told. How did you feel when you got your positive diagnosis?
Well, I actually was in shock. And I was in shock and just thought, well, I ended up doing what I wanted to do and ended up getting this. So it's really nobody's fault but my own, you know. But I was shocked to find out after I came back from Sydney that I had it. Mm. Yeah.
Back in the day, even if you were working the streets, sexual health was probably not high on your list of concerns.
Yeah. And I think I would have caught it through drug use. Because
sharing equipment.
Sharing needles and all that kind.
Back in those days, was there ever... Did you clean them? Did you bleach them? Anything in between uses, or you had to get that hit?
I just kept buying new ones.
Or and sharing.
Or if I didn't have any, just share it. And a lot of my tranny friends end up dying using dirty syringes.
From they didn't OD. They just had caught something. They were. Mm. Was it HIV and AIDS or other diseases they caught from sharing equipment?
Most of it was from HIV, AIDS, that they passed away. But it would have been about 6 tranny friends that died while I was still there working. And that sort of snapped me out of it too, because how I got back to Darwin, I met a man. He'd come and seen me on the street. I ended up having sex with him. Next minute I was driving back to Darwin with him and hanging out at the same time, but he looked after me. And he ended up being my partner for about 8 months.
Is he from Darwin or?
Yes, he lives out at Humpty Doo. And he used to be a teacher at Bachelor College.
Had you met him before?
Yes, through friends as Phyllis, and then he ran into me in Sydney.
Maybe he's looking for you.
Might be. Yeah, Sean Ryan. He worked in one of the communities outside Alice Springs for maybe 13 years as a school teacher. And then after he retired from there, come to Darwin. And I met him from Sydney. And then, yeah.
That trip home, that where he took you, was that when you pulled up stumps and you left Sydney for good?
Yeah. Even stopped using, hanged out in the meantime, coming up to Darwin.
So you were withdrawing on this?
Mm. Yeah, from heroin.
Do you remember if you... People can get very ill. Did you get ill?
Not that ill. Like, ill enough to lay down and don't move, that kind. But not ending up in hospital or anything like that.
So at the end of that car journey?
Yeah.
Were you clean?
Yeah. I smoked ganja.
I mean, clean from heroin?
Yeah, I was clean from heroin. And I went back to my auntie where I moved when I was a teenager. And she took me in. She even gave me a bed with my man.
Wow. Can I ask you about, like, just being your sense of acceptance and whether you... I know your parents didn't approve, but what about everyone else? Like,
Mostly everybody in Darwin accepted me, because I ended up living with different straight friends here and there all over Darwin. And that's why I really didn't care, because I had the support and care that I needed. So... I just lived on.
I even asked Gary this. Did you ever feel a sense? He says, "Oh, I'm from Darwin. I can never feel unsafe in Darwin." Did you ever feel unsafe at any time in your life, even here in Darwin, where you know there is a support network, where you know the streets, and it's a small place?
Yeah. The only thing I used to get scared of is when picking up strangers from the pub or things like that. That's the only thing. But I usually can tell if I'm going to get any... if they're going to get any trouble from them or anything. So
can you sense it? I mean, it's just like a deep sense of an awareness.
What you learn when you're working on the streets, being a prostitute, you learn all of that. You know how to read people, body language, everything.
It comes in handy. You need to be able to kind of... get a sense of people real quick.
Yeah, well, like here.
In Big W?
Yeah, for thieves. I keep telling these, and I said, I used to be the best thief in Darwin, so I know every little movement and thing. They understand. And then now it's time to go back to Phyllis.
So tell me about that, when you're presenting as Philip. But tell me, you made a decision to go from Phyllis to Philip.
I only went back to Philip to get that education and have a career, and I did. I ended up in health for 20 years.
In that career, you were always Philip?
Yeah, always. But everyone knew me as Phyllis.
Hmm. You presented to work as Philip just for ease, I guess, for sake of ease. And then, but now at this age, you've decided to go back.
Yeah.
Tell me about what's going to happen, because you will go back on hormones, or you're back on them now.
I'm back on hormones at the moment, and then once I stop working, I'll just look after Phyllis.
What are the can you tell me, I've never known anyone who's been on hormones. I've known people, but I haven't really asked them this question. What are the changes that you notice first when you're on hormones?
Well, the breasts start getting big, and then your facial hair slow down in growth. You end up getting a figure. Yeah. And the only time I stopped the hormones was when I was Philip.
For a long time, though. That was, what, 15?
20-something years.
And are you noticing from this time taking hormones after, almost 20 years, does it feel different or...
It just feels same. Same. No, I never ever had problems with having hormones. And a lot of doctors say you're going to have, things that will happen to you, but nothing.
No depressive episodes, no mood swings?
Nothing.
And are you looking forward to being Phyllis again?
Oh, yes. I'm even going to change my name real in Deepole now, because Gary Lee gave me that Phyllis. He changed it in Centrelink when he worked in Centrelink.
He changed the records because he worked there.
He changed my name to Phyllis. And I got Centrelink under Phyllis.
And what difference did that make to your life, having to look at, you've got to go to Centrelink, get your payments, and being identified in Centrelink as Phyllis? Did that feel good?
Yeah, I was really happy. So this time I'll be changing it under Deepole.
So everything will be changed.
Yeah.
When that court case happened in Sydney, was there any change? How did the law respond? Because it would mean that the other person in your case had a right to no longer be placed in a men's prison where their life would almost certainly be endangered, or they would definitely be suffer some kind of sexual attack. How did things change after that? Can you remember any significant change?
I think because we were the first ever to do that, people started to sort of take notice, and my friend was happy because she wasn't going to a men's prison, because they, whenever she went to prison, they'd send her to a men's prison, and she was overjoyful to go to a female's prison,
And primarily she feared what might happen.
Yeah, from the men's prison, because they just used her, so wasn't any pleasure in the jail.
And then, so you were always protected. You're always, if you were in prison, you're always in the protective wing with the child molesters and other people who needed protection. So that was a good thing. I mean, at least you don't have. I guess you didn't have that to worry about.
I remember the first time I went to jail, they picked me up on the street, and when you go to jail, they reverse the truck to the reception in Long Bay, and right next to the reception is the main yard for the main prisoners. Yeah.
So they can see you coming in.
Yeah. So whenever that bus comes, reverses to that reception door, everybody just comes to the fence.
See who's coming in.
And to make it more worse, I had to be the last one to get out of the bus. Well, as soon as they seen that fishnet stockings, they screamed, "Send her in here." So I was crying, don't send me there. So that was the only scary part that I had when I first went to jail. But after that, I did 1 week there. After that, I was crying to get out. Didn't want to leave.
To stay, because you had everything you needed there. Protection, So was it always mob who were looking after you in Long Bay?
Yeah. So it would have been the other gays or trannies that were doing longer times,
And there would have been, as there is now, a high proportion of Indigenous, more mob in jail. Was that how it was when you were in jail? There was always mob there?
Yeah, there was always countrymen in jail. So And one thing, they always, if there was a new person in the jail, they'd just, you know, introduce themselves and become your friend or whatever.
And they could identify you as a black fellow immediately. Yeah. So if I went into jail, I'd probably have to say where I come from, who my mob was, and or yeah, it might take a little bit of time.
Anywhere you go in Australia, countrymen will always come, where are you from? Like that, so you automatically just tell them. And then you're right then.
Passport, you got the passport, black passport. Yeah. Anything that you wanted to say? I mean, I know we're running out of time because you're on your lunch break, but anything that you would like to say before I ask you one last question? Anything that you feel like I should have covered?
I reckon all our mob, be what you want to be. And now it's more, a little bit more safer too now that, you know, everyone knows what trainees do and transsexuals and that. So do what you want to do.
And we're thinking about this question of pride. You know, Sydney World Pride, the word pride is used a lot. Could you just, in the last few minutes that we've got, could I ask you just to think about what pride means to you, and how it's a kind of an essential part of life? Yeah, maybe it means nothing to you, I don't know. But just to reflect on that word pride.
Like I said, I knew what I wanted. I lost my virginity at 12, that kind. You know, so I was looking for that kind of stuff. So, just be pride in yourself and do what you want to do.
Yeah, don't let anyone stop you. Or do you kind of think about pride in the course of your death?
Mob with us black fellas, it's a different story because of family. Because we all grew up one family. You know, none of this. Or you're the outside like that. It wasn't like that. And there's always one person that doesn't like it in the family, so you just got to accept it and just try and get away from it whenever it happens.
And that acceptance, I think once we're accepted by our families, whoever it is, even if our parents don't accept us, we know we will find acceptance for who
elsewhere.
We are.
You know, we don't need our family to accept us. I always found it with other friends too. You know, even though I knew my father didn't like it, and because of the religion and that, I always knew what I wanted, and I went for it, and I did it, and I'm still going.
Do you ever think what does retirement mean to you, and like, how would you like to spend the rest of your life?
As Phyllis, and just do my voluntary work and wherever I can get it.
Kind of voluntary work?
Whatever. Caring for people or...
You want to just give back?
Yeah. And I think by giving back, you learn more and you get that feeling that you're needed and, you know, that's what I learned too from working. I reckon that's it.
Yeah. Well, you've been very generous in your lunch break. I'm really sorry that it had to be, you know, a rush job, because you're such an important person. Phyllis, thank you so much for making time for this.
Thank you for coming.
Lovely to meet you.